Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 426. In this episode, Scott talks with Damian Edwards about ASP.NET vNext.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I've got my good friend Damian Edwards on Skype with me. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm lovely. Actually, I'm actually not lovely. I'm extremely tired. I've week and a half ago now, TechEd really took a lot out of me.
Yeah, a lot happened that week.
Yeah, I ended up doing like four talks, and I did a talk with David Fowler, did a talk with Scott Hunter, and basically have been sleeping ever since. It's pretty ridiculous. Yeah, doing these kind of events, it involves a lot of preparation and a lot of, getting things right. We ended up doing the build that we showed. Gosh, that was built the day before?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Do we usually do that? Like, I know that we get a beta ready or an alpha ready and we present it, but I can't remember one where the programmer who works on it gave me a build like a couple of hours before the talk.
Yeah, I've seen that happen more frequently since I joined Microsoft just over 4 years ago. But I think this is probably the biggest example I've seen of that, where this wasn't just a build of some new extension or some new template or some new library that you bring into an existing sort of thing. This was, here's a build of a completely new stack that we're going to sell to the world sort of mm-hmm. thing. Yeah.
Why do you think it went down like that? I mean, is this an example of we're not organized and we're not sloppy, or we are sloppy rather, or is this more of a, we're doing everything in the open, so here's what we're thinking.
It's very much the latter, and us opening the doors much earlier than perhaps we have done in the past. Not mm-hmm. even perhaps, than we have done in the past. This is about us being open, and as soon as we have something that we think is enough to construct a message around, there's kind of a fine balance, right? Even in open source, around how soon do you show people your thinking when you have a large sort of incumbent user base, without freaking everybody out. And so in this case, it was, while this was the time we felt that we had enough of the new thing to show people that we could sell sort of the core principles, the core things that we were using to make decisions on when we build this new system. And that just happened to line up pretty well with when TechEd came on. But mm-hmm. We were doing things right up to the last minute because, there's a lot of people involved and there's a lot of moving parts and things break daily at the moment. We're still at that phase where things are breaking pretty regularly more than they're working as we tease out and sort of try out a lot of these ideas.
Yeah, it's funny that you phrase it like that, that you have to get something ready in order to kind of like quote unquote sell it. Of course, mm-hmm. everything we're doing is free right now. But the idea that I actually saw some complaints on Twitter, like maybe five or six, the predominant response was very positive, but I literally saw some responses like, this isn't very open sourcey of you. You're showing us this stuff that you've been working on in secret for months. And it's like, well, gosh, do you want to see the check-in mail that says initial check-in?
Yeah.
Like here's hello world. Is that the level of early? Like, does open source always require the very, very first spike to be completely public?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's no one answer to that. Like, I think that's a personal choice per project. Some people like not to show their ideas. And let's talk about open source at the personal level first, and then we can talk about it sort of the corporate level. Mm-hmm. as a personal thing, a lot of people are very open and happy to put their work out there as soon as it sort of leaves their hands and goes into the individual studio or whatever they're using. Resilient enough and confident enough or whatever the description might be, to say, hey, here's what I'm working on right now. Give me your worst. Do you hate it? Do you think I've done, you know, I'm stupid? Do you think I'm doing amazing things? Whereas other people like to sort of incubate and think and iterate before they think this thing is ready to show to others, and that they're kind of, I guess, emotionally ready to accept criticism or to accept feedback. I mean, some ideas need time within someone's head to tease apart and to sort of mesh again before they're ready for other people to come and tell them it's the worst thing, or that, you know, they can see the thought that's gone into it, et cetera, et cetera. At the corporate level, I think, you know, it's not one person. There are a lot of people involved, and it's not just the people working and committing code. It's all the other people that we have to convince that this is the right idea. And so if we just started doing all of our prototype hacky things in the open, some of those things would be fine. Things that are kind of adjunct to our existing story, there wouldn't be much harm in doing that. And we've done that quite a lot. You know, we've had stuff that goes up on our previous Codeplex site, which was very much a preview or very much a prototype, and we sort of communicated it as that. And then there are other things which we're really, you know, we're sitting down and taking a good hard look at the last 15 years of our story, and then trying to come up with a story for the next 15 years. Mm-hmm. And those things require a lot more careful consideration by a lot of people. And I think there needs to be a period of sort of introspection and iteration internally to get enough people sort of agreeing internally that this is the right direction before we then share that externally. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in this case.
And so how, juxtaposing that, you know, was this something that people were hacking on for years, or how much time from, wow, I think we could do this, to, wow, I think we should show this to people?
We've been kicking around this idea for over 2 years. I'd probably go back 3 years. I can remember meetings we had nearly 3 years ago where we were discussing this idea of a sort of server optimized profile of .NET. Mm-hmm. And then a new set of ASP.NET frameworks to sit on top of that, and what that type of transition and change would look like. Mm-hmm. And you know, there were very, very, very early prototypes around those. None of those you would even consider functional.
Right.
They were experiments to see what it would look like to use a different CLR than the one that's in Windows, for example, the core CLR, which we've talked a little bit about in the past few weeks. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really until mid last year that I think a few people really started to hack stuff together. In fact, it was David Fowler, while we were still working on the release of Signaler 2, who one night went home and decided he was going to try and port MVC to run on top of Katana, our Owen-based sort of web framework stuff.
Owen being open web interfaces in .NET. It's
open source,
not us. It's a community-based interface that describes how to plug middleware together.
Right, and of course, MVC has been based on System Web ever since it came out. System Web being, you know, what we ship in the .NET-based class library as the current ASP.NET sort of development stack. Mm-hmm. And he literally went home over a weekend and came in on the Monday and said, "Okay, well, here's the work I had to do to get Hello World working on MVC on top of Katana." And that was porting the existing MVC code base. That wasn't writing it from scratch. It was literally, you know, clone it from Codeplex and then comment out as much as you can until stuff works.
Right, which is a pretty typical spike. Like,
yeah.
So let's back up and think about the timeline. So you said a couple of years ago, people were brainstorming kind of ideas of the future. And this is very much, wouldn't it be crazy if we could?
Yes.
And then you're looking around, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're looking around the company and you're saying, oh, well, the CLR team has been doing these crazy ideas, because they always have a fork or a spike of different versions of the CLR where they're brainstorming things.
Absolutely.
And we, the ASP.NET team, who are not the core CLR team, are looking at them, and we'll meet with them occasionally and say, hey, that's kind of a cool idea. Mm-hmm. And then simultaneously, you've got other groups doing, you know, quote unquote crazy stuff, like getting Node to work in Visual Studio. That's another group that's going off and doing their thing. And these ideas are gelling, while simultaneously you're working on the thing that we ship all the time, ASP.NET proper. Then when did someone decide to go into you know, GitHub and start doing, putting these things together in a more cohesive way?
Yeah, that happened, I think, about November last year. November. So I think the commit timelines show that.
That's a good point. People can go back, and now that these are public Git repositories, see initial check-in, I suppose.
Yeah, and I'm sure that initial check-in wasn't empty. Like, I'm sure there was some stuff that had come from someone's laptop.
Oh, yeah.
Or some internal repository. But pretty much the timeline that you can now see publicly on those repos represents the timeline of that code base. There were previous code bases, as we talked about, that were spikes and prototypes and thought experiments. And then a lot of the new code base is the underpinnings were very much written from scratch, like the KLR, the K runtime, as it's called, which is the sort of the piece that actually boots the CLR, either the desktop CLR or the core CLR. That's all new. And it's C++ and a bunch of crazy code that I will never dream of understanding. And then there's the sort of middleware sort of pipelining stuff, which was very heavily inspired by the work we did in Katana with the IAP builder and the Owen sort of dictionary idea of a chain of functions that get executed, which is what ultimately becomes your request handler. That work has sort of flowed over from Katana. And then there are pieces of functionality from Katana, like the authentication middleware, the static file middleware, mm-hmm. the welcome page. Those things were just almost complete ports. So we moved them over as code bases and just fixed the things that had to be fixed. Then there is the frameworks on top, MVC, where that's more of a conglomerate, and we're rewriting parts of that as we go. We're treating this as the opportunity to try and fix some of the things that we didn't particularly like about MVC. I mean, MVC has been through 5 major versions now. And so we're taking this opportunity to, and we released Web API last year, right? So we had sort of another web-based framework for dealing with request response, which was tuned for a particular type of scenario, but there were a lot of similarities. And we got into this situation where we had MVC, Web API, and SignalR that had a set of cross-cutting concerns that weren't cross-cutting. Like, they weren't implemented in a cross-cutting way. They each had their own idea of dependency resolution. They each had their own authorization. They each had their own logging. And because they were all developed in isolation, essentially, and released at different times, there wasn't much coherence between them. And so this was our opportunity to say, let's build a new core set of hosting abstractions and common concerns, such as logging and DI and a whole bunch of others, configuration. And then let's port those libraries and merge them where appropriate so that they all sit on top of these common concerns. So now in your application, when you use those three, and this includes things like Entity Framework as well, when you use these libraries together, they'd look like they were designed to work together because they were all built at the same time and they're all sharing common pieces. Now, a lot of people might be listening to this and thinking, well, isn't that just .NET? I mean, .NET has always shipped. If we think about the base class library as this large set of frameworks that all share common components. And to an extent, that's true. The difference is that .NET always shipped as a large set of components, whereas in this case, we've taken the opportunity to make everything modular. And so we're very big on this pay-as-you-go sort of idea when you're developing your app, when you're composing your application and pulling different pieces together. In this world, you really do start with nothing. And from there, it's up to you to compose the things together that you want for your application, and thus you'll only pay for those. But when you do, they should all look like they work together.
Yeah. That's interesting. We should break it down with a little historical context. And yeah. I think maybe people, you and I should work together on a blog post about this, because people 10 years ago would install this 200 or 300 meg runtime that would put a complete framework, arguably one of the most complete base class library frameworks, short of Java, that said, here's default functionality from system.datetime to .threading that you can start with. So, hello world didn't involve go and get a bunch of libraries.
Right.
You literally had them all already, but it required an, 300 meg install and a reboot. Mm-hmm. That's the lowest level. And when I would teach this at the university level, when I was teaching C#, I would go and do hello world. I do a console.write line. I do a for loop and I'd look at it in ildasm, the IL disassembler. And I'd say, look, here's the base that we build on top of. That is well tested, reliable, wonderful. The CLR is kicking butt, but the desktop CLR requires this big install. Then move up a layer, we created system.web, and people shouldn't conflate web forms, the style of development that abstracts away the statelessness of HTTP, the idea of a button.click existing in the web world. They shouldn't conflate that necessarily with system.web, right? And underneath that is HTTP handler and HTTP module, which are kind of what we thought of as being atomic, the atoms that we built our systems on top of.
Right, yes. And the interesting thing is that at the time when ASP.NET System Web was designed, really the only two or three things that you were building on top of those were web forms or web services as a MEX, because if you remember back to the .NET days, the whole sale of .NET was around heterogeneous connected systems, service-oriented type architecture. And ASP.NET's role was to build the UI for that and to host services for that. Mm-hmm. And then the other things were just, the everything else, handlers to serve binary data or to serve files or to allow file upload. And they were really the things that you built. And the underpinnings were, you can see in the underpinnings, the way that the HTTP handler system was built and the way the configuration system is built, that that's what they were built to support. And so as new models evolved on top of, in the web development world, we were still building on top of these underpinnings. Now, you can go a long way, and certainly we did. We went a very long way in adopting some of these new models. But ultimately, to use your Hello World example, when you did Hello World in ASP.NET, you were still pulling in an awful lot of infrastructure to serve these other three things just to do Hello World. Now, Hello World obviously is not a real example, but the difference in this new stack, I would contend, is that when you do Hello World in the new stack, you don't have to pull in any subsystem other than this is how you handle an HTTP request. And when I say handle, you execute this delegate or you execute this function.
That's really interesting, because if you take the concept of just Hello World and you say, like, here's Python.
Right.
Put Hello World, print in Hello World and then say, and look, here it is, Hello World at the console level. But I think Windows people sometimes are used to things like Visual Basic 3 or Visual Basic 6 from 15, 20 years ago. And it's like, here's Hello World. And there's this form, and there's a button, and then they drag Hello World a button over, and they go, look, it's Hello World. And they go, oh, that's the base. That's Hello World.
Right.
But they forget about the fact that Visual Basic sat on top of Win32, which sits on top of painting APIs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a Hello World at an HTTP handler level versus at a WCF, channel level versus at web forms is very different. And I think it's funny that we see these benchmarks. There's a Tech Empower benchmark that keeps coming up every once in a while. And they'll go and they'll compare like a web service created in web forms saying Hello World or a web service in web API saying Hello World with the lowest level handler in a Node app or a Java app. So it's like, here's a motorcycle versus a minivan versus a single wheel with a jet engine attached to it.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then they don't take into consideration that, like, well, how am I going to take the kids to school and soccer practice on this wheel attached to a jet engine?
Right. No, I would, in defense of those benchmarks, we look at those benchmarks. We think that's actually a really great community-driven effort. Those benchmarks are just data. And what you read into those is actually completely at the discretion of the person looking at the data. Mm-hmm. The benchmarks don't claim to be a measure of one system's capabilities more
valid
than another.
Valid point. They're just a big spreadsheet.
Yeah, and even more to that point, they actually go out of their way to do comparisons such as, if I take a core system like Java, or frameworks built on top of the Java language and the Java runtime, or perhaps just the Java runtime, and we do something at the lowest possible level, and then I add a framework that's on top of that, and I do effectively the same thing, what is the delta? And of course, the value you get out of that is that you now have an understanding of what overhead, what is the cost in the framework that you've chosen over the thing upon which it is built. And then it all becomes trade-offs, right? They're not saying that that's bad. They're saying that, when you get a minivan, you're getting a whole bunch of stuff that allows it to serve its purpose as a minivan. But that comes at the cost of, if you're going to do a drag race, you're going to be slower.
Exactly. So then fast forwarding to today, it feels like we're looking at what's great about the CLR, what's good about new things that didn't exist 10 years ago, like NuGet, new thinking around how assembly loaders work, and then the innovations around the core CLR, which is a CLR you could install side by side, as well as things like Roslyn.
Yeah.
All these kind of new, I feel like I'm always using the Lego analogy,
yeah.
but it's like, sometimes I get these old timers on Twitter who are like, you know, when I was a kid, these are the Legos we used, and I don't like these custom parts. Well, you know, I was at the Lego Museum. I went to, you know, to Denmark. I met them and they said, well, you know, after the innovation of this part, and they all have funny names for the parts, you know, like once we had like the lantern, you know, brick, they call them elements.
I see.
Once we innovated this element, there was a lot of controversy around. I don't want to create a Lego brick with a stud on the side. But then it opened up an entire new world. And then now for this generation, this has become a Lego piece that we can all count on. And once you can count on it, it completely opens your eyes. So for example, you know, Roslyn changes thinking completely
yes.
about how you can do something and why you should do something. And someone might say, well, this is a weird, new, strange world that we're opening up. Are we sure we want to do that? But once you accept it, then you realize, like, wow, we can do stuff we couldn't even thought of before.
It's almost baffling that anyone in this industry would feel that way about innovation. When you consider that in every other industry, whether it's, you know, mechanics or architecture and buildings, and everything gets the advantage and the benefit of, you know, improvements in design or the adoption of new techniques in manufacturing or new materials. The buildings we built 100 years ago are very different to the buildings we built now. Mm-hmm. And that's the time scale that industry works on. Our time scale is much shorter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we deal on the web where, you know, I know you say quite a lot, the time scale web years is kind of crazy, mm-hmm. right? You know, a week is years in the web. And we've been working on this ASP.NET framework now since the late 90s. And when we made the transition from ASP Classic, as we call it, to ASP.NET, a lot of the APIs that exist in ASP.NET and mm-hmm. a lot of the behaviors are actually there because as part of that transition, we opted to tick the compatibility box. We said, hey, we're going to make it so that you can drop an ASP page or just change the extension to .aspx
mm-hmm.
and it will run in ASP.NET. And so a lot of the APIs and a lot of the programming paradigms exist in ASP.NET because they actually came over from ASP. And so if you add that timeline on, we're dealing with a web framework and ideas that have been around for quite some time. And this, I think this is really interesting because I've been here listening to like your talks with Douglas Crockford, and he was interviewed on another podcast recently, and your latest Hansel Minutes I listened to this morning about computer science stories with, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but I know he works in Australia. Yeah, and it's just how much we take for granted about what we use in technology today is the way it is because of decisions that were made decades ago,
mm-hmm.
many decades ago. And every now and then, someone sits up and says, you know what, a lot's happened in the last 20 years. Perhaps this is a good opportunity for us to break the mold and, you know, keep what we think is really good about what we do now,
mm-hmm.
but look at better incorporating the things that have happened in that, you know, that last period of time.
So looking at that idea of breaking the mold, like we've got WinForms, which I still write stuff for. We've got WPF, and they are different and parallel, and I see people doing stuff in both. Like Telerik has a bunch of great new WinForms controls
right.
that are new, innovative, and being added on top of, even though WinForms is arguably done. Like people right. are always like, oh, is it dead? Well, it's like, well, it gets bug fixes and it's finished, but people are building on top of it with some amazing stuff. So if we look at this with WebForms versus what's going forward with MVC and Web API being kind of converged, there appears to be this kind of web forms framework and then MVC, which comprises of both MVC, what we know of historically as MVC, and Web API. They've now converged. But what have we done in the last year around web forms?
So web forms is in an interesting place in that it's in the analogy you draw to WinForms is kind of similar, but I wouldn't even go as far as that in the case of WebForms. So WebForms, we did a blog post recently about all the stuff that we've done in web forms, and I made some announcements during the week of build at the same time that we talked about ASP.NET VNext to do with web forms, mm-hmm. and some of them may have been a little confusing because we use some of the same terms. And so, for instance, we just shipped a preview of a Roslyn-based code DOM provider, which typically you would use in a web forms application or an MVC application that used the web forms view engine or the Razor view engine. Mm-hmm. So code DOM is the mechanism in .NET that existed before Roslyn that allowed you to write code from code. It is a DOM-like API. You have a tree with nodes, and you add expressions and this mm-hmm. and that. And then once you have that tree, you can, say, turn this into a C-sharp string. And then once you have that string, you can compile it using whatever compiler you have. Now, in ASP.NET today, that all happens by calling out to the C-sharp compiler. Literally, csc.exe gets called when we compile your .aspx page on the web server. And then that resultant assembly goes into the temporary ASP.NET files folder that everyone mm-hmm. right. knows and adores. So the new thing that we released was a re-implementation of that based on top of Roslyn. And there are two main benefits that you'll get out of using this. One is that obviously you get to use new language features that exist or that are coming that are based on Roslyn, because all new language features from here on for C-sharp and VB will be implemented in the Roslyn-based compilers, not the old compilers. Mm-hmm. So we needed to do that work to support new languages. And two is a performance improvement. So as your ASP.NET site gets more complicated and as you have more folders and more assemblies in bin, the cost of spinning up that executable, csc.exe at the command line, dozens and dozens or even hundreds of times when your application starts up to compile all the pages in your application mm-hmm. Can get very high. It can actually be exponential depending on the structure of your application. And so the new compilers that are based on Roslyn have a lot of clever tricks around caching so that when we call the compiler over and over again, you don't pay that cost again. And so we have some example data where a fairly complicated application with hundreds of assemblies in bin and hundreds of views in the application can take 40 minutes to compile using the old compiler and can take a minute or two to compile with the Roslyn-based compiler.
So that's really interesting. So this is potentially, older web forms apps, kind of venerable web forms apps that the kinds of things you see in large enterprises, large line of businesses, mm-hmm. hundreds and hundreds of pages. I know we've all been there with multi-minute long builds and multi-minute long warm-up times.
Yes.
So arguably the kind of the oldest, most reliable thing we have is now being given support for the newest, most amazing thing we have.
Yeah, and it's funny because the actual catalyst for doing this, like right now, was we had a customer contact us through customer support saying they were having trouble with a very large application taking a very long time to compile, which was affecting their ability to sort of react as a development team because they would make a change and it would take 40 minutes to see that change result in the application. Now, it turns out we were able to help them with some of their architecture stuff so that they could get that time down. But we took that opportunity to say, now might be the right time to go and look at building this new code DOM provider replacement based on Roslyn and see if we get a benefit. And it turned out we did. And so we've released that as a preview. And the plan is that as Roslyn continues to release previews and towards an RTM, we will keep in step until they hit RTM and then we'll hit RTM. Mm-hmm. And it's just a NuGet package, to be clear. You can just NuGet this into your existing MVC or WebForms application. And just to reiterate the point, it's not just about WebForms. It also works in Razor mm-hmm. pages in MVC as well. Then once you NuGet it in, you'll get the benefit immediately. And if you do pre-compile using the ASP.NET compiler.exe, it also gets used for that as well.
So then arguably, it's almost like this new thing, this new pipeline, the new side-by-side ASP.NET VNext is like a new kind of vehicle that's been created. And that doesn't mean existing vehicles are going to change or stop. And since you can not only NuGet in Roslyn support, which is going to give you basically C-sharp 6 support before C-sharp 6 is available, you can NuGet in to web forms, friendly URLs, the new identity subsystem, all the new EF6 support. These are now parallel. Like there's almost like there's a high occupancy vehicle lane and there's a regular lane, but we're on the same freeway. We're going forward. You can still, we, I guess I'm funny. When I'm in podcast mode, I don't usually say we, but Microsoft can continue to put stuff into web forms with NuGet packages and add onto it and et cetera. So people who are already invested in web forms don't necessarily need to care about the new ASP.NET VNext pipeline. It's just a different lane that they could move to and from.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a decision that, you know, any application team will make as they make any sort of decisions. And, you know, to be clear, all those new things that you just sort of listed off for web forms, that is work that we did. It's not like that those things just...
No, that's not old stuff. We released that like a couple months ago.
Right, and it's not like those things, you know, we did the identity version 2 work and then that just magically works. No, we did the identity 2 work and then we, you know, consciously did work to make it work in web forms.
Right, right.
And we will continue to do things like that as appropriate, you know, for web forms,
right,
that, where it makes sense to that new subsystems that we deliver would have immediate benefit in web forms, mm-hmm, and the cost involved in doing so, sort of the trade-off is worth it, then we will continue to do that.
So then arguably, as reality is typically a hybrid application, like you'll see a web forms app in a large enterprise with a Redis cache, you know, with MongoDB, they might have ASP.NET vNext using web API in a segment of their app. They may have the web forms aspect of their application and the Redis cache. And they're going to use all these things together. So is it really, like we talked about years ago, one ASP.NET and correctly sized Lego pieces all working together? Is that actually happening?
Yeah, I think so. The only distinction really would be that with the big one ASP.NET effort, a large part of that message was sort of saying, look, you can use these things within the same application from sort of a VS and IIS point of view.
Right.
Because if I think about an ASP.NET application, I don't really think about it being bound to one process. And like
more people should think about that. Like,
right.
I just put out my little startup, and it actually has three ASP.NET applications.
Right.
But I think
which
of it
make
as
up
one.
A larger one.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so, you know, that will continue to work even with the new vNext stuff we're talking about. Like in IIS, you'll still be able to have a root application, which may be the full, you know, full desktop and running a web forms or a previous version of MVC, and then you can have a sub application of that, or a sibling application that you make look like a sub using something like URL rewrite. Have them run in different app pools, but you can still share, you know, authentication tokens between the two, and you can still share code, the business logic code and whatnot, by way of, you know, either cross compiling or using portable class libraries, which are the .NET way of sharing compiled .NET code between different platforms. All those mechanisms still exist, and I think anyone who has worked with ASP.NET for a while and has built anything sizable will know that you get to a point where it makes good sense to split out the application into multiple physical IIS applications, I guess, and even perhaps distribute them onto different machines. But you generally consider them still as part of the same overall system.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't any different.
That's cool. I think that we are heading in the right direction, aren't we?
I certainly hope so. But you know, the thing is now that we're out in the open and people are giving us their feedback, and so if we listen, which I like to think that we do, then we're going to end up in a good place. And so far, people seem to like the core principles that we're kind of basing this new system on. So mm-hmm. I'm confident we're heading in the right direction.
Cool. And people can, of course, check all this out at ASP.NET/vNext. They can check it out on my blog. And also GitHub, if they really want to see what's going on, github.com/ASP.NET. They can see the commits. And you guys are committing directly to that, right?
That's Yeah, and I will say again, this is really early days. So now is the time to get in and have a look under the covers if you want to influence some of the big pieces of this vNext system. Because we are working daily on this thing, and you can see the commits as we make them, including the feature branches where we're doing work that isn't in the main trunk yet.
Okay. Well, thanks for talking to me. I really appreciate you setting us straight.
No, glad to be here again.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.